Good day, and welcome to today's Made in America conference. At this time, all lines are in a listen-only mode. Later, there will be an opportunity for you to ask questions. If at any time during the conference you'd like to register to ask a question, you may do so by pressing the star, then one on your touch-tone phone. At this time, it is my pleasure to turn the conference over to Ms. Michelle Wasslin. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you, Aaron, and thank you to all of you for joining us for today's call on the issues of immigration reform, the 14th Amendment, and birthright citizenship. I am Michelle Wasslin. I'm the Senior Policy Analyst at the Immigration Policy Center. IPC is a nonpartisan organization that provides policymakers, the media, and the general public with accurate information about immigrants and immigration policy in the United States. The series of papers that IPC is releasing today on this issue of birthright citizenship can be found on our website at immigrationpolicy.org. As we all know, citizenship laws in the U.S. are very complicated, just like they are in every country. But one thing is clear. With very few exceptions, everyone born in the U.S. is a U.S. citizen by birth, whether the parents are citizens, legal immigrants, or undocumented immigrants. And that's what we refer to as birthright citizenship. Most recently, we've seen controversy over birthright citizenship in a really unlikely place, the 2008 elections. And during the last election, as we all know, the legitimacy of both major parties' candidates was questioned. Republican candidate Senator John McCain was born on a U.S. military base in the Panama Canal Zone. And, of course, President Barack Obama was born to a U.S. citizen mother and an immigrant father in Hawaii in 1961. But this call today is not about the birthers, not about that controversy, because more typically the question arises with respect to illegal immigration. Immigration restrictionists and others claim that denying citizenship to the children of undocumented immigrants and other immigrants will decrease illegal immigration by removing an incentive to come to the U.S. illegally, and would also result in cost savings to the United States. Our speakers today are going to discuss how neither of these goals would be realized by denying birthright citizenship to the children of immigrants. Attempts to restrict birthright citizenship have reared their heads over the past several years. Numerous bills and resolutions and amendments have been introduced. For example, Elton Gallagly of California has sponsored legislation since 1991. Representative Nathan Deal of Georgia has introduced a version of his bill several times, and this year's bill already has 84 co-sponsors, the last I saw. Representative Ron Paul of Texas has proposed amending the U.S. Constitution to deny birthright citizenship. Now, to date, none of these proposals have advanced very far. In 1995, there was a significant number of bills that had been introduced, and the House Immigration Subcommittee went so far as to hold a hearing on the issue. And during that hearing, 14 witnesses provided a range of arguments for and against modifying U.S. citizenship laws. During the comprehensive immigration reform debates of 2006 and 2007, birthright citizenship amendments were floated as well. And the states are also getting into the action. There have been proposals to deny citizenship to the children of undocumented immigrants in Texas, and now they're considering one in California. So as this debate over comprehensive immigration reform heats up again this year, we know that birthright citizenship may again arise as a legislative issue. But regardless, it's important that Americans have factual information about U.S. citizenship laws, how changes to birthright citizenship would affect us, and what denying birthright citizenship to children can and cannot accomplish. There are many questions surrounding this issue. There are legal questions. There are many practical questions. And there are questions about who's behind these efforts to deny citizenship to babies born in the U.S. and what are their motives. So to answer some of these questions, we have a great panel of speakers. I'll introduce them all to you first. Our first speaker will be Elizabeth Wydra of the Constitutional Accountability Center. And Elizabeth is going to provide us the historical context for the 14th Amendment and challenges to it. Margaret Stock is an immigration attorney in Anchorage, Alaska. She's also a lieutenant colonel in the Military Police Corps and an associate professor at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. Margaret is going to discuss the practical impact that a change to citizenship law would have on all of us as Americans. And finally, Eric Ward of the Center for New Community provides an African-American perspective on the 14th Amendment and examines the motives of the groups that are at the forefront of current efforts to abolish birthright citizenship. So now each speaker will give a short presentation, and after they have all spoken, we'll open up the lines for questions. So Elizabeth, would you like to get us started?
Yes. Thank you so much, Michelle. It's a pleasure to be here with you and with all the folks on the call today. I'd just like to thank IPC for hosting this event and releasing this publication about such an important issue, and of course for kindly inviting me and the Constitutional Accountability Center to be a part of it. The subtitle of today's publication being released today is Myths and Facts About Birthright Citizenship. And certainly recent debates have shown that there are some troubling myths out there about the Constitution and citizenship. I think perhaps even more troubling, there appears to be a willingness in some quarters to wholly disregard the Constitution's guarantee of birthright citizenship and the values of equality and dignity enshrined within that guarantee. But to start off today's briefing, I thought it might be useful to first discuss some basic facts before we pull the curtain back on some of those myths. The 14th Amendment to our Constitution was drafted in the wake of the Civil War and begins with a guarantee of equal citizenship that, quote, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States. These words are known as the Citizenship Clause and provide birthright citizenship, that is, automatic citizenship at birth, to all those born on U.S. soil. This type of citizenship, by which citizenship is determined by place of birth, stands in contrast to the other primary method of determining citizenship, by which citizenship is passed down through a bloodline or descent. Sort of, if you want to impress your friends and neighbors with the Latin, our type of citizenship is known as jus soli, or law of the soil, and the other kind of citizenship is jus sanguinis, or law of the blood. And I promise that's all the Latin I'm going to use today. The 14th Amendment's grant of automatic citizenship at birth means that all children born within the U.S. are equally U.S. citizens, regardless of whether the U.S.-born child's ancestors came over from Europe on the Mayflower, were forced to come over from Africa on a slave ship, or were recent immigrants from Asian or Latin America. The only exception to the 14th Amendment's broad rule of birthright citizenship is that children born to parents who are not, quote, subject to the jurisdiction, end quote, of the United States will not have automatic citizenship. That basically means children of foreign diplomats, for example, who have diplomatic immunity and aren't required to comply with U.S. law, or if there was an invading army occupying U.S. soil, children born to those hostile combatants wouldn't have birthright citizenship for obvious reasons. But perhaps most important to today's briefing, the 14th Amendment Citizenship Clause includes automatic citizenship for children born on U.S. soil to alien parents, regardless of immigration status. This is not only the interpretation given to the Citizenship Clause by the Supreme Court, it is also the understanding of the clause that was shared by both supporters and opponents of birthright citizenship in the Reconstruction Congress that drafted the 14th Amendment. There was no dispute at that time that birthright citizenship would be accorded children born in the U.S. to alien parents. Instead, there was fierce debate over whether this was a wise thing to do. Congressional opponents of birthright citizenship expressed hostility to immigrant groups such as the Chinese in California and the Gypsy or Roma population in eastern states like Pennsylvania, and they worried that birthright citizenship would encourage migration or reward those who commit, quote, trespass clause, refused to allow these prejudices to be incorporated into the 14th Amendment. Instead, they set forth conditions for citizenship that depended on place of birth, an objective circumstance, not on whether one's ancestors were alien or citizen, slave or free. Modern anti-birthright citizenship constitutional arguments are debunked in detail in my article in the report being released today, and I'm, of course, more than happy to discuss the substance of these arguments in the Q&A session if anyone would like to hear more. But I would just like to close my remarks right now with a comment on the wisdom, or lack thereof, of current legislative and political attempts to tinker with the broad and clear definition of citizenship written into our Constitution. The 14th Amendment's provision of equal birthright citizenship righted the terrible wrong of the 1857 decision in Dred Scott versus Sanford, which, as you probably know, was the case in which the Supreme Court held that persons of African descent born in the U.S. were not citizens under the Constitution because of their race. Our nation fought a civil war in part to remedy this terrible mistake, and those who drafted the 14th Amendment in the wake of that war knew very well how important it was that inalienable rights, such as the rights of citizenship, be enshrined in the Constitution itself and not subject to the whim of the legislature. Congressional debates at that time show clearly that the drafters of the 14th Amendment intended to make birthright citizenship dependent not on the favor of a political majority, but rather on neutral, fixed conditions. The drafters of the 14th Amendment didn't choose these objective conditions for citizenship because they were some sort of, you know, enlightened legislative angels. Just as the debate over illegal immigration today can grow heated and sometimes ugly, a quick glance at the floor debates in the Reconstruction Congress shows that, along with grand statements supporting liberty and equality, ethnic stereotypes and racial hostility were also on full display. But those who drafted the 14th Amendment to our Constitution wisely placed the conditions for automatic citizenship beyond the prejudices and politics of the day. We would be wise to follow their lead. Political advocates who seek now to withdraw automatic citizenship from children born on U.S. soil to alien parents are not just ignoring the text of the Constitution, they're also ignoring the lessons of its history. And so I think with that, I've probably used up my time, and I'll hand it back to Michelle, but I'm glad to elaborate on any of these points in the Q&A.
Thank you so much, Elizabeth. And now we'll move on to Margaret Stock.
Thank you. Before I get into the substance of my remarks, I want to make sure it's clear to everyone that I'm speaking today in my personal capacity only and not on behalf of any government agency. I've been asked to talk about the policy arguments in favor of retaining birthright citizenship, and that's a fairly easy task for me because the reality is that those who oppose birthright citizenship or seek a change in the rules and laws concerning birthright citizenship don't make out much of a policy argument. In fact, the argument mainly boils down to somehow illegal immigration problems will be solved if the rule regarding birthright citizenship in the United States is changed. And opponents of birthright citizenship, or those who seek a change in the current rule, make out no arguments whatsoever about how, as a practical matter, a change would be accomplished. But as I point out in detail in the paper, this change in the current interpretation of American law would impose tremendous hardships, financial and administrative, on all Americans. And this is something that just hasn't been considered in the debate. Before getting into those too much, I do want to emphasize that it's my view, based on my review of the constitutional provisions and the history, that Jim Ho is absolutely correct in his assessment that you would need a constitutional amendment in order to change the current American rule regarding birthright citizenship. And his conclusion has been buttressed numerous times by leading legal authorities, including the Office of Legal Counsel of the Department of Justice, which says that constitutional amendment would be required to change the current rule and that the legislative proposals are patently unconstitutional. So I want to mention that at the outset, but then turn now to the policy arguments. The first most important thing to understand is that we've been operating on a very simple rule for more than 100 years now. And the simple rule says if you're born within the geographic boundaries of the United States and you can produce a valid birth certificate, you're an American citizen, and that's not subject to challenge. You're a constitutional citizen. If you can't show that, you fall into a very complicated legal regime, one that immigration lawyers are intimately familiar with, where you must, in order to prove American citizenship, either be a naturalized citizen, meaning that you've obtained lawful permanent residence and applied for citizenship, or you have to prove citizenship through your parents or grandparents. And the process of doing the latter is extraordinarily complicated. As I talk about in the paper, an American citizen who is born abroad but seeks to prove citizenship through derivation, or as earlier was mentioned, the law of jus sanguinis must produce numerous documents, historical records, must show that a parent had American citizenship, lived in the United States for a certain period of time, must talk about parents and grandparents' length of residence here, how, when they were married, whether they were married before or after the child's birth. There's basically a whole host of legal considerations. And it's been my experience that often it takes an experienced attorney about an hour to figure out whether somebody's actually an American citizen by derivation under the complex rules that Congress has set up. These complex rules have evolved over several centuries. They differ based on the time of a person's birth and when their parents came to the United States. And essentially, they're just incredibly complicated on the order of patent law or tax law in terms of their complicated nuances. If we eliminate the relatively simple rule that we have now, then we're going to foist on all Americans a regime where everybody has to go through the exercise of proving that they've derived American citizenship somehow. And opponents of birthright citizenship never discuss how this would be accomplished as a practical matter. It appears to me from looking at their proposals that they would have to establish some sort of national birth registry to register all births, that every time someone's born in the United States, there would have to be an adjudication regarding their parentage. So someone would have to make a decision to go and look at the records concerning their parents and try to figure out if their parents are in fact United States citizens. And this is not an easy thing to do. It's not something that can be done easily at a hospital where kids are born generally in the United States. It's going to require an expert immigration lawyer to make these determinations. If anybody has any doubt about that, they can simply look at the record of the Department of Homeland Security right now on making these determinations. And it's quite a mixed record. What we found is that people who are claiming derivative American citizenship must apply to the Department of Homeland Security or to the Department of State for a decision on whether they're in fact derivatives or not. And the Department of Homeland Security, because of the complexity of the law, frequently makes mistakes on this issue. I've, as an attorney working with military families, have found that military families face this issue frequently, and they're often finding that when they have a U.S. citizen child who's born abroad, they attempt to prove that to the Department of Homeland Security and are told their child is not a citizen. And it's always, generally speaking, an error by Homeland Security, but it's because the laws are extremely complicated and the department has trouble applying them. I've also run frequently into cases where the State Department says someone's a citizen and the Department of Homeland Security says that they're not, and you end up in litigation or other administrative difficulties because you have two departments of the United States of government, one saying you're a citizen and one saying that you're not. These cases are not uncommon, and it's increasingly a problem in the United States for even American citizens who have passports to establish that they are U.S. citizens if they were born abroad. We've got cases now where they're being denied driver's licenses even when they present their United States passport to a state DMV because the DMV says you need a birth certificate showing you were born in the United States. I don't want to go into too many details about the complications of these cases, but I will tell you that every immigration lawyer in America is working on cases like this now, and they're increasingly common because of the recent emphasis on proving citizenship for various benefits that people are getting. And governments, state, local, and national are increasingly denying American citizens certain benefits because these American citizens don't have the proper proof. If we change the birthright citizenship rule, we are going to multiply these problems dramatically. And this is something that opponents just haven't considered. Another aspect of the debate that goes unremarked for the most part is not only the issue of how every American will be affected by this, but the costs and benefits have never been weighed. As I said before, the assumption seems to be by opponents that making a change, a major change in the law or changing the Constitution would suddenly be of a benefit to America because it would reduce illegal immigration. In fact, it appears to me that in fact the opposite would occur. We'd have increased illegal immigration as a result of changing this rule because it wouldn't be possible for people to stop the generational change that happens now when somebody's born in the United States, they're an American citizen, and that stops the family from continuing to be illegal for generations, as has happened in some other countries. So we probably have more illegal immigration as a result of changing this law, not less. We'd have traded a very simple and easily understood rule for a very complicated one. And finally, we'd have deprived our nation of the benefits of birthright citizens. I find that in debates on this issue, opponents invariably bring up the names of people that they feel should not have been accorded birthright citizenship. And the first one that always comes to mind typically is an individual named Yasser Hamdi, who was born in Louisiana and left the United States as a very small child, got involved with Al-Qaeda, and came to light when he was brought back to Guantanamo Bay and it was discovered that he was an American citizen. So people say, point to Yasser Hamdi and they say, we should change this rule because of Yasser Hamdi. Hardly any of the opponents look at the list of birthright citizens who have contributed to America, who have helped our country. They don't look at Bobby Jindal, governor of Louisiana, a birthright citizen, a quote, anchor baby in the terminology of the opponents of birthright citizenship. He's also born in Louisiana as a small child to a mother who was here on a temporary visa. And I very rarely hear opponents of birthright citizenship looking at the lists of great Americans who have been able to contribute to our society because they are birthright citizens. But they number in the hundreds of thousands. So in the course of the debate, I think it's important, as in any immigration policy debate, to look at the costs and benefits on both sides of the debate. And in my estimation, from reviewing the costs and benefits of a change in this policy, there has been complete neglect of the cost to the United States of changing this rule. So my contribution to the debate is simply to say, if you want to think about changing this rule, someone needs to sit there and look hard at the costs and benefits of such a change. And as I said, I don't believe that a change is warranted if you actually take a look at those costs and benefits. And that's the main point of my paper, and I would invite questions about the realities of those Americans who are having trouble today proving their citizenship. But I think we need only look at the current or the past presidential campaign to see how much time and energy both John McCain and Barack Obama spent refuting allegations that they were not American citizens, to see what every American would face if we in fact change this rule. Thank you very much, and I will turn things back over to Michelle.
Thank you so much, Margaret. And finally, we have Eric Ward.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. This is Eric Ward with the Center for New Community, a national civil rights organization based in Chicago, Illinois. I just want to take a few moments to take a look at the 14th Amendment, and in hopes that we don't overlook its importance, particularly in light of the debate on immigration that's occurring in this country. And I think in regards to the most recent marches that occurred in D.C., where people were challenging the citizenship of Barack Obama and earlier John McCain. What I'd like to talk about is the importance and symbolism of the 14th Amendment and the symbolism that it carries for the African American community. And I believe that all supporters of civil rights should be concerned about the history of organizations behind these present-day attacks on the 14th Amendment. Finally, undermining the 14th Amendment does nothing to resolve the broken immigration system that exists today. The 14th Amendment is the very basis of American citizenship, created in the aftermath of the Civil War in response to continued discrimination against African Americans. It provides the first and only clear definition of citizenship in our Constitution. For African Americans, the 14th Amendment is the cornerstone for key civil rights laws, such as the right to vote, equal access, and protection against job discrimination. In the last decade, there have been several attacks on the 14th Amendment. Despite its proud history, anti-immigrant organizations have launched an assault on the 14th Amendment. While it is certainly unfair and inaccurate to generalize all opponents of birthright citizenship as racist, several of these groups have unsettling ties to white supremacists. Some of these groups include the Federation for American Immigration Reform, a group designated as a hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center for its relationship to political extremists, including white nationalists. Its founder, John Tanton, funded the organization with funds from the Pioneer Fund, which promotes pseudoscience called racial eugenics. The Council of Conservative Citizens, an organization that traces its direct lineage to the White Citizens Councils who opposed Martin Luther King Jr. and the civil rights movement in the South. And finally, VDARE, a project of the Center for American Unity. VDARE publishes writings that promote anti-Semitism and racism. VDARE, ironically, is named after Virginia Dare, allegedly the first white child born in the United States. These examples illustrate that the movement against birthright citizenship is not simply an attack on the 14th Amendment, but a skirmish in a wider war, a war on civil rights and equal treatment under the law in the United States. Despite this fact, over the last several years, some elected officials have picked up the philosophical mantle of these organizations and launched their own assault on the 14th Amendment. For example, Representative Mark Foley introduced House Resolution 44, the Citizen Reform Amendment, which would have amended the Constitution to eliminate birthright citizenship to babies born in the United States unless one parent is a U.S. citizen or a permanent resident. Another, House Resolution 1940, was introduced during the 110th session and was eventually sponsored by 103 members of the Congress. Most recently, Representative Nathan Deal reintroduced his birthright citizenship bill, H.R. 1968. There is no reason to believe that eliminating birthright citizenship would be effective in stopping or slowing illegal immigration, for there is little evidence that attaining citizenship is the main incentive for immigration to the United States. The pejorative term anchor babies, used in an attempt to make these attacks on the 14th Amendment palatable to the American public, is nothing more than a fictitious problem that has little impact on immigration trends today. Given the way these attacks on birthright citizenship threaten civil rights, it should perhaps be no surprise that they fit uncomfortably well with the long, tragic history of nativism and racial discrimination in the United States. When one pairs this push to undermine the 14th Amendment with today's social anxiety over the election of the first black president, a very disturbing trend appears to be occurring in regard to our nation's commitment to equal opportunity and treatment under the law. Altering the 14th Amendment citizenship clause would amount to redefining what it means to be an American, and it should be treated with suspicion. This, in turn, would open the door to further circumscription of citizens' rights. This is the path that African Americans can ill afford to travel. Whatever one's position on immigration policy reform, shaking the foundations of American citizenship is the wrong way to go about achieving it. I present this information here today so that when attacks on the 14th Amendment begin anew, there should be no surprise expressed by elected officials of the political backlash they should be prepared to experience from both civil rights supporters and the organizations that represent them. I look forward to taking any questions.
Thank you so much, Eric, and thank you to all of the speakers. I think they gave us a lot to think about. Erin, if you could please give us the instructions again for asking a question, we could get started.
Certainly.
With that.
At this time, if you would like to ask a question, you may do so by pressing the star, then one on your touch tone phone. If at any time you'd like to withdraw your question, you may do so by pressing the pound key. Once again, star, then one to ask a question. We'll pause for just a moment to allow questioners to queue. And it looks like our first question comes from Cindy Carcamo with the Orange County Register. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much. Maybe this is a question directed to Margaret Stock. I have a question in regards to, you mentioned a little bit, but I think I missed it a bit, about how this actually wouldn't deter people from coming to the country illegally, doing away with birthright citizenship. I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit on that, maybe give some specifics.
Sure. From what I've learned from looking into it, most of the people who actually come to the United States knowing that we have a birthright citizenship law and planning to have children here actually come legally. So since they're coming legally, it doesn't make any sense that it would deter illegal immigration. I think there's this myth that there are pregnant women running around down on the southern border trying to cross the United States borders in the middle of the night to have their babies here.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not actually the case. The people coming in only for the reason, apparently, of having children here are coming in legally, not illegally. And so I just don't see how it would deter illegal immigration at all. There's also, as one of the other speakers pointed out, most of the people coming into the United States illegally are coming here for jobs or to be reunited with families who are already here. So those are their reasons. They're not coming here just to have a baby and then run back. And then there's a common myth out there among the public that somehow if you have a baby here, you get to stay. And that's not true. Since 1996, we've had very tough immigration laws in place. Having a baby here doesn't mean you get to stay if you're here illegally. It just means that you get deported and you have to make a decision whether to leave your baby, who's an American citizen, behind or take your child with you. And the reality is that most parents who are deported don't leave their U.S. citizen children behind. They take them with them. And as a result of this, we have extremely large groups of American citizen children growing up in foreign countries now. There's whole colonies of them in some countries. Or U.S. citizen kids are growing up overseas in foreign countries because their parents have chosen to take them back home. The parents can't get back into the United States, and it's because of the tough laws we have. The children can't sponsor their parents until the children are 21 years old. The children have to be residing in the U.S. as U.S. citizens in order to sponsor their parents for the most part. And they have to meet the poverty requirements. So if the children are poor at age 21, they can't bring their parents back at all. They have to be middle class or higher. They have to file a petition to sponsor the parent. If the parent's been in the United States illegally for more than a year or entered illegally, the children have to overcome some significant barriers in the law, including 10-year bars for which there are no waivers for parents. I'm very familiar with this because right now, in fact, I have some military families who live in Orange County, California, who can't cannot bring their parents back in the United States because the children were born here in the U.S., but the parents were illegally present in the U.S. and departed and are now banned from the United States and just cannot get back. So although their children are, you know, the pejorative anchor babies and are serving honorably in the United States military and are U.S. citizens, their parents are barred from the United States.
Oh, that's interesting. You and I should touch base afterward, perhaps.
Yeah, I got a lot of these cases, a lot of them in California, and they're quite heartbreaking because we do have military personnel, you know, serving in the war right now, putting their lives on the line, winning medals, and their parents are barred from the United States.
Wow.
Can't get back in.
And Michelle, you could hook me up maybe with Margaret afterward, I guess?
Definitely.
Okay, perfect. Perfect. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Okay, Aaron, next question.
Our next question comes from Juan Esparza with Vida en el Valle. You may go ahead.
Thank you. Someone mentioned earlier the similar legislation proposed in Texas and California. I'm aware of the one in California, but can you explain a little bit of the one in Texas and what's the likelihood that that will gather enough support that it could actually maybe even possibly make it to the governor's desk?
This is Michelle. I can begin to answer that question. I don't know if any of the other speakers have more information. We know that State Representative Leo Berman in Texas introduced at least one bill to deny birthright citizenship in the state of Texas. As far as I know, that bill did not advance at all in the legislative session. I think that the idea is to try to drum up some support for these bills or pass the bill perhaps at the state level so that they would trigger a lawsuit so that eventually it would become a legal issue for the United States to deal with. Maybe some of our legal scholars could respond a little bit more to that question. But unfortunately, I don't have any more information about the Texas bills.
But at the same time, this is a national issue, so the states would sort of be very limited into what they could do. Is that correct?
This is Elizabeth Weider from the Constitutional Accountability Center. So, you know, certainly there's been some talk that some of these state efforts could be used to push a challenge, you know, because as Jim Ho's article in the report published today says, you know, it's probable that you would need a constitutional amendment to change automatic birthright citizenship. And so if a state changes that through their own efforts, then that could push this issue forward, and there could be a direct challenge, because there really hasn't been, even though there have been all these proposals in Congress, the Supreme Court hasn't considered this issue really since the end of the 19th century. So I suspect that some of these efforts are an attempt to actually push this issue forward, knowing that they might meet with opposition from the federal government that could say that these state efforts are unconstitutional and in violation of the 14th Amendment.
Yeah, I can address the Texas bill a little bit. Basically, it's a bill that would deny public benefits to people. It looks like what you'd have to do if it passed, if you wanted to get, for example, tuition at a Texas college or university, you'd have to prove that your parents were not illegal immigrants at the time of your birth. And so let's say you're an 18- or 19-year-old Texas resident and you want to go to a Texas college or university, you're going to have to go in order to get resident tuition at a Texas college or university, or go to school, elementary school or anything like that. You'd have to prove your parents' status at the time of your birth. And that's pretty difficult and complicated to do. It's not, it seems, for some reason, people seem to think there's some registry of people that shows on any given date what their immigration status was, and there isn't. So somebody that wants to go to a Texas college or university, presumably, and if this bill gets passed, is going to have to, go back and get a bunch of historical records and prove what their parents' immigration status was on a given day, the date of their birth, in order to get those benefits. But it covers professional licenses and employment and retirement, public assistance benefits, disability benefits, a whole bunch of state benefits would be not available to people unless they can prove that their parents were legal on the date of their birth.
Thank you.
Thank you. I just want to remind everybody that the papers that have that we're releasing today are available at IPC's website, immigrationpolicy.org. Aaron, do we have another question?
Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press the star, then 1 on your touch-tone phone. If you'd like to withdraw your current question, you may do so by pressing the pound key. Once again, it's star, then 1 to ask a question. It looks like our next question comes from the site of Belen Rodriguez with Telemundo. Please go ahead.
Yes, thank you. I have a question for Margaret. Could you explain how Americans will be burdened by the issue of documenting their claim to citizenship? I know that you talked about some cases that you've had about one agency says, no, you're not a citizen, and another says yes. Does this happen often, and how often do you have any numbers or specifics of these cases?
Well, it happens often enough that I think I run into one of these cases every day, me, myself, and I'm just one attorney in America. But I'm sure in law offices all across America, lawyers are running into these cases. The classic one that we see right now, and you'll see piles of these cases if birthright citizenship gets repealed, because people have to rely on the derivative laws. Congress passed a law in 2000 called the Child Citizenship Act. And it was supposed to make it very easy for children to prove their citizenship in the United States, even if they were born outside the U.S. And this law, of course, doesn't apply right now to people born inside the U.S. All they have to do is show up with a birth certificate and they're American citizens. But if birthright citizenship were repealed, the child citizenship law would apply to all children born in America, and so they would face this challenge that I see pretty much on a daily basis. Child citizenship law is supposed to be really simple, and it says if one of your parents is an American and you're residing in the United States with a green card under the age of 18, then you're an American citizen. And that sounds really easy, and Congress thought it was going to solve a big problem they were having with children who thought they were American citizens but turned 18 and found out they weren't, and then the government was trying to deport them even though they'd lived in the U.S. since they were little kids. Congress passed this law to make things easier, but the net result of this law has been that often today the Department of State will issue a passport to a child under this law, and the child will have a U.S. passport and be acknowledged by the Department of State as a United States citizen, and then will end up getting notices from the Department of Homeland Security telling the child that they're an illegal alien and they're going to be deported. The reason this happens is because the Department of Homeland Security doesn't share data with the Department of State, so they don't know that passports have been issued to these kids, and the Department of Homeland Security doesn't check their files to see if parents are U.S. citizens, and they don't have an easy way to do that. So the only way they update their system is if the child files a very expensive form that takes about a year to adjudicate right now. And you know, once that form's adjudicated after a year, then the Department of Homeland Security will update their computer files. This is a really common occurrence happening all the time. I was recently involved in a case in California with two American citizens who had a child that's 8 years old who got a threatening notice from the Department of Homeland Security saying their child was going to be deported because they hadn't filed an immigration form. Of course, they thought their child was a U.S. citizen, so they didn't realize they needed to file an immigration form, and they got extraordinarily excited, their military family. The husband was facing deployment, and he was just being told that his 8-year-old kid was going to get deported by the Department of Homeland Security. We were able to resolve that by getting them a passport and then by having them file the paperwork with DHS, but it's going to take a year before they have an adjudication from the Department of Homeland Security, and they've had to pay several hundred dollars to DHS to get that adjudication in place. I just use this as an example of what's going to face every American family with kids, because everybody's going to have to go through these steps of getting passports and then filing forms with DHS to get your child acknowledged as a citizen by both departments. And those steps will be necessary because we don't have a national birth register of American citizens. We don't have a national list of who's a U.S. citizen and who's not. Right now, we rely on a very simple rule that if you can produce a valid American birth certificate, you're an American citizen. Super simple rule. If we get rid of that, we end up with the default rule of relying on our extremely complicated derivative citizenship laws.
And I think also, this is Eric Ward, you know, what's important to remember that if the birthright citizenship clause is removed, you know, there is a burden on the children of American citizens, and this puts the African American community in a peculiar quandary when you look at the fact, at least according to the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, that currently in the United States, 2 million African Americans lack the required identity documents to prove their citizenship here in the United States. Some of that is because of Jim Crow laws, where older African Americans were not allowed to be born in hospitals in the South and were never issued birth certificates. So the burden on young African Americans who have to rely on their parents to prove their citizenship here in this country becomes very complicated and dangerous.
Great. Aaron, do we have another question?
Yes, our next question comes from the site of Carlos Galindo with Radio KASA Spanish. Please go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. You know, in Arizona, as you many of you know, we're going through quite a battle here, and we have individuals like Russell Pierce, state legislator, who actually now a state senator, that proposed a one-time birthright citizenship alignment act. We have other individuals who are U.S. congressmen like Trent Franks, who supported H.R. 1868, and I believe was a co-sponsor. Andrew Thomas, the county attorney, who has time and time again misinterpreted laws that were passed by the voters against immigrants. And Joe Arpaio, of course, our notorious Joe Arpaio, racially profiling through what he calls crime suppression sweeps. My question to you is, how do you see Arizona, since you have your finger on the pulse of the nation regarding immigration issues, how do you see them as a trendsetter for anti-immigration laws and possible pioneers in birthright citizenship laws, given the hostile environment here in Arizona?
Wow, that's a great question.
This is.
Any of the speakers want to address that?
I will just really briefly. I mean, this is Eric Ward again from the Center for New Community. I mean, my response in regards to Arizona is that we have seen, I think we have a case study of where venomous anti-immigrant policy, how it can destroy and divide the community. And I think each of us, has to ask ourselves around the country, do we want the United States of America to look like the streets and cities of Arizona, where people are living in fear, where the economy has been wrecked by bad anti-immigrant laws, where neighbors are afraid of one another, and the end result is that it has done nothing to correct immigration laws or to deal with the problem of migration in the United States.
Thank you for that that statement. That's very accurate.
Thank you for the question. Do we have any more questions, Aaron?
Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star, then 1 on your touch-tone phone. It seems we have a follow-up question from Cindy Carcamo with the Orange County Register. Please go ahead.
Hi, it's Cindy again. I have a question in regards to, I don't know if you guys have heard about in California here, there is an initiative that they're trying to get on the ballot. It's actually out of San Diego County by a gentleman by the name of Ted Hilton. It's called Taxpayer Revolution. I'm wondering if you guys could give me your thoughts on that. Basically, it's trying to eliminate the a birthright citizenship. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that initiative and what you think of it. I mean, I can imagine what you think of it, but I'd like to get some feedback from you guys about that.
Well, I'm amused that people think that the birthright citizenship rules being changed are not going to cost anything. In fact, I think it's going to be extraordinarily expensive to change the rules. And California, I thought, was having significant budget problems right now. So to add literally billions of dollars in burden onto the government because you're going to verify everybody's parents and grandparents and their residence in the United States just seems really bizarre to me. But if you have unlimited funding, I suppose, you know, to hire lots of lawyers and have them work at hospitals, then, you know.
So you say it's going to put the burden on the government there to be able to verify, that we were talking about, to be able to verify, you know, people's citizenship, you know, the parents' citizenship and all that. So basically the gist of what you're saying is that it's actually more expensive than, more costly than it is beneficial.
Well, it's going to cost everybody. It's going to cost the private sector and the government. But the government's going to have to somehow determine who's a citizen and who's not. And they're going to have to hire lawyers to make that decision. They can't just have a person that's unskilled in the complexities of this incredibly complex law. You know, it's kind of like if you decided you're going to have somebody who works at a gas station do corporate tax returns. You know, you just can't do that. You'll have outraged citizens. So you're going to have to hire a bunch of lawyers to figure out who's a citizen and who's not. And it's extremely complicated to do. But it will create a lot of jobs for lawyers.
It will create a lot of jobs, and, you know, I think, again, if you look back at the climate that was created during Proposition 187 in California and the years that I think it took for the state to heal politically but also at the community level, and I think that the citizens of California should be wary. Again, it is a measure that was developed with attorneys affiliated with the Federation for American Immigration Reform, and I think that it should be looked at in regards to what are the larger term impacts of this measure and what is the larger term goal of the Federation for American Immigration Reform that has such notorious ties.
Thanks, Eric. I think with that, we are at the end of our hour. I'd like to thank all of our speakers, Elizabeth, Margaret, Eric, for all of the great information. I remind you all that the papers are available on our website, immigrationpolicy.org. And if anybody would like to follow up with any of the speakers on today's call, please call IPC's communications manager, Wendy Sefsaf, and she is at 202-507-7524. Thank you again for joining us. Have a good afternoon.